Peter Guralnick's written many pages on American music and musicians, including a prize-winning two-part biography of Elvis Presley. Now, Guralnick's turned his attention to the great gospel, soul, and pop singer Sam Cooke, with a book called Dream Boogie, The Triumph of Sam Cooke. Peter Guralnick talked to Ann Strangechamps about the life and music of Sam Cooke.
I've been knowing you for some while.
That's true.
And you've always had a tinkling of soul. Every day I try to describe soul. Maybe you can hum 8 bars of what soul represents. Sam Cooke's yours. He'll never grow old.
In the introduction, you describe his music as emanating from or maybe expressing a kind of, I think you call it, purity of soul. What did you mean by that?
I think that like a number of great singers, his music conveys a sense of deep-seated emotional commitment in almost anything he does, whether it's something that you immediately like or not, whether it's in a format that you like or not. Jerry Wexler, who was the vice president of Atlantic Records and recorded many of the great, great singers of the 20th century, said that Sam had the greatest voice of all, bar none. Ray Charles said to me shortly before he died that Sam was the one and only. Not only did he hit every note, but he hit every note with feeling. The point is that Sam hits home so. He had such an extraordinary sense of drama, and he had such an ability to communicate a meaning that was not necessarily in the text or the lyrics, much like someone like Aretha Franklin, something that reached out to every one of his listeners, whether it was in an in-person performance or it was in the grooves of a record.
Mm. Musically, he began in gospel. That remained a big influence on his life, on his career?
Oh, it remained a huge influence. He brought the gospel sound into pop music to a considerable degree, more and more in his own work as time went on, but in his producing of other artists on his own label, on the label that he and J.W. Alexander started, Sire Records, the gospel element was really the undercurrent. But in his writing also, and he never strayed far from gospel, he continued to write gospel songs, and some of his greatest compositions, which the world at large may know less well than his pop compositions, but some of his greatest compositions were gospel songs that he wrote after he had left gospel music, like Jesus Be a Fence Around Me or Stand By Me, Father, along with songs like Nearer to Thee, which he had written as early as 1955 when he was with the Soul Stirrers, and which was the beginning of his first flourishing as a songwriter.
They were singing, Nearer, my God.
Why did he decide to cross over to pop music? I mean, was that a difficult decision for him to make? I mean, his father was a minister.
His father was a minister. His father might have liked to have seen him remain in gospel music, but his father had a very strong entrepreneurial streak. His father worked as a union leader at Reynolds Metals in McCook, Illinois, and he purchased 2 limousines to carry fellow workers out to McCook for a price. This was one of his ways of moving on up. And he had taught his children, he had taught all of them to accept no limitations. And part of that acceptance of that refusal to accept limitations was a refusal to accept economic limitations. And so from Sam's point of view, moving over into pop music was really triggered by the success of Ray Charles's I Got a Woman. I mean, that caused a revolution in popular music because it showed the way in which a gospel music could be introduced into the pop strain. And it showed the success that could be achieved. But from Sam's point of view, it was really a very simple matter of receiving the appropriate recompense for his labors.
What was his first big pop hit?
His first big pop hit was You Send Me, which is really almost the most innocuous of songs with a mixed male and female white chorus that just really kind of bleaches it out.
Darling, you send me. I know you send me. Darling, you send me. Honest you do, honest you do, honest you do. Whoa.
There's a story you tell, wasn't it one of his first managers who said Sam first sang him that song and he thought, where's the song?
Yeah, no, that was actually his guitarist, Cliff White, who met him for the first time in order for Sam to teach him the song or to play the song for him. And Cliff kept saying, this guy's lost his mind. There's no, you know, there is no song here. He's just going to go on forever saying, you send me, you send me, you send me. And Steve Allen made fun of it on television. You know, this was the limitation of rock and roll song lyrics. I mean, he made fun of this in general. But Sam's point here, and I think in a more sophisticated way later, was that it was simplicity that led to communication with your audience, that what you wanted to do was to present a song in a manner that allowed every listener, male, female, black, white, rich, poor, to pick up on its intrinsic message.
Do you yourself have a favorite period of Sam Cooke's music?
I think in terms of his own writing, I would say the last couple of years of his life. I mean, when he was singing songs like Bring It On Home to Me.
If you ever change your mind, go about leaving, leaving me behind. Oh, bring it to me, bring your sweet loving, bring it on.
The other remarkable things about Sam Cooke is that he was one of the first African-American performers to have his own record label, you know, in a music industry that at that time was completely dominated by white men. Did Cooke see having his own record label as a political act?
Oh, I think so. I mean, he was a very self-aware person. I mean, Sam Cooke was someone who was not only reflective but was deeply analytic and who in his reading, for example, I mean, he was a voracious reader and read everything from Tolstoy to John Brain's Room at the Top to The New Yorker, to James Baldwin, to an increasing concentration on black history, which was inspired by the work of John Hope Franklin, and particularly, I think, by the book From Slavery to Freedom.
Yeah, didn't his daughter describe their home library as being the first black history library before anybody really heard of that term?
Yeah, I mean, she was just saying that, you know, there were no studies. There were no black studies departments at that point, and they would go out to the Aquarian bookstore in Los Angeles, which was one of the great black bookstores in the country. They would go out to the Aquarian bookstore. This was an increasing interest on his part, a deep-seated commitment from the beginning. I think he considered deeply what the implications of capitalism were. He would, I don't know if teasing his manager, Jess Rand, who was his manager for about 5 years, very deeply versed in show business, a sophisticated guy, and it started out as a song plugger for Irving Berlin. And Sam would drive Jess crazy by telling him that just as the communists were winning the elections in Italy, soon they'd take over the United States because that was justice. I don't think that he was being literally, I don't think that was literally what he believed any more than he converted to the Nation of Islam. But he was extremely interested in the political implications of all of these things. And the idea of owning your own record company, the idea of profiting off of your own labors rather than letting others take all the fruit of your labors was, I think, at the basis of his political ideas, which, if you extrapolated them, came down to the same concepts of black pride and self-determination, which the civil rights movement and the Nation of Islam, in different ways, were attempting to impart.
I was born by the river in a little tent. Oh, and just like the river, I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come.
In the last year of his life, in the last few months, after Change Is Gonna Come had come out on the album Ain't That Good News, in early 1964, Sam's song, "The Change Is Going to Come," became a kind of anthem of the civil rights movement in the immediate aftermath of its release. He donated it to a Southern Christian Leadership Conference, an album that was being put out as a tribute to Dr. Martin Luther King and as a benefit for the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. And he accepted an invitation from Dr. King, whom he knew, to perform at a civil rights event, which would have taken place in early 1965, but as it turned out, after he died.
That song was released then after he died. How did people respond to it?
Well, the song was released in early 1964, the song "A Change Is Going to Come." It came out on the album "Ain't That Good News," and it was embraced almost instantly by the civil rights movement. It was due to come out as a single at the time that Sam died, and it was released as a single, and it did quite well as a single. But it wasn't as if, because of its posthumous release, you could say, let's say, with Otis Redding's "Dock of the Bay," that probably its place on the charts was to some extent enhanced by the fact that Otis Redding had just died. In the case of "A Change Is Going to Come," while it did well on the charts, all of Sam's songs did well on the charts, and the song itself had already been embraced by the movement. Sam had donated it to this Southern Christian Leadership Conference album, and more was finding an increasing identification with the movement.
It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes it will.
Peter Goralnik is the author of "Dream Boogie: The Triumph of Sam Cooke." He spoke with N. Strange Champs. Sam Cooke died at the age of 33 in December of 1964. He was shot by the manager of a motel in Los Angeles.